Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello, and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Today is kind of a special episode for me. It's 150 episodes, which I can't believe I have gotten this far. It's gone quick because it's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed talking to some pretty awesome people over the last close to 2 years or 3 years. I think in February now, it will have been 3 years of doing this podcast. I haven't missed a Monday yet, which I've been grateful to have been able to keep up that consistency. And ultimately, I'm just so thankful to all of you for continuing to listen. And the listens go up every week, which, you know, and just that's a testament to you guys. You're sharing it. It's getting out there. And I really appreciate that. If you do enjoy it, I'll make the ask again that you do continue to share it and maybe post an episode that you enjoy on social media or share an episode with somebody that you think might appreciate it. It helps get it out further and promote kind of this idea that we're trying to share here on the Herd Quitter Podcast, to being a herd quitter and thinking for yourself and learning and growing to improve your ranch, farmer ranch business. Today I thought would be kind of an interesting idea to do for this 150th episode would be to go back onto my top five episodes and essentially cut out a short clip of maybe I think around 10 to 15 minutes each on each of those top five episodes that I thought were really great pieces of information, great parts of their story, and just play them here to kind of refresh your memory on what they were saying. And if you guys end up doing what I did when I listened back to a part of them to try and catch a clip to use in this, I ended up re-listening to all of the episodes through again and really enjoyed every one of them. There's a reason these are the top five. And so that's what I think I'm going to try and do. But before I jump into those, I wanted to share a quick highlight of our sponsor for this podcast, and that's Barn to Door. And Barn to Door, what it is an all-in-one solution for farmers selling direct. My wife and I, we've been using them now for over 3 years. They are our online e-commerce platform. They allow customers to order products from us both online and in person. We use them for our inventory management and integrate with our email platform, and they just do so much. They've really allowed us to help increase our sales and operate our business efficiently and successfully. So if you're looking to build a successful farm business with best-in-class training and support, I'd really encourage you to check out Barn to Door. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, and that's where you can learn a little bit more about the success we've had using them. And if you choose to sign up with Barn to Door, you'll get access to a free academy session. They do those sessions all the time, and they're a $99 value. And again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. But the first podcast that I listen is actually number five. It's the fifth most listened to episode of the 150 episodes that I've done so far. And it's with Ray Markser. And Ray Markser is the author of Cowboy in a Corporate World, which highlights his experience in his time working at the Matador Ranch, which was owned by Koch Industries. Is a phenomenal story. And in this one, he shares a little bit about some of the major changes that he made to make that ranch successful and even more profitable. Things from grazing management to reducing winter feed costs, virtually almost eliminating those winter feed costs, and making some genetic changes to the herd to be more efficient. And I think it's just a pretty awesome testament to what can be done. And it's even more expanded, you know, in his situation at scale. But we'll dive into this conversation with Ray.
You know, there were some pretty tough conditions. Like when I went to Sage Creek, it was pretty tough shape. It was high desert and low rainfall. I mean, 9 to 12 inches annual precip is what it is. Mm-hmm. And about 90 days of growing season. They expected 90 days of growing season, but statistically it's only 66 frost-free days.
Sure.
But so it was pretty desolate. I tell people that there's a place in Sage Creek called Big Basin, which was a literally big basin. It was about 4.5 miles long, 2.5, 3 miles wide, just big flat little creek with absolute no willows ever had been there, ran down to the little of it, about a foot wide, 3 inches deep. And there was a shearing shed at the bottom end of it where they sheared sheep for many, many years. There was a shearing plant there where there was 27 separate shearing heads where 27 shears could go at one time.
Wow.
They sheared a band a day there. But so you can imagine what the country looked like. I told everybody when I went there that first fall in 1974, you could stand on one end of Big Basin and count every cow turd from the whole length of it. It was that denuded. And so we started a rest rotation grazing system that following year with Gus Horn and the BLM. And it's it was one of three demonstration projects of rest rotation grazing on a large scale.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot there too. But I spent 11 years there at Sage Creek running that. We'd bring cattle in. We got up to as much when the rest rotation was really responding and favorable conditions, about 2,300 pair a year. Plus then I ran about 600 or 800 yearlings in some other country there. Mm-hmm. And then they'd go, most of them would go back to the blacktail for the winter. But
and the blacktail was the main ranch?
Yeah, right, that was the Beaverhead ranch. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's meadows. There's a headquarters about 10 miles from Dillon. There's 3,000 acres of irrigated farm ground there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go about 7 or 8 miles up, and then there's about 10 or 12 miles of sub-irrigated meadows, lush meadows, but the Blacktail Creek runs down through it. Some of the most productive land in all of Montana.
Yeah.
Grow 2.5 ton to the acre of native forage in there every year. And so that's where we wintered a lot and springed a lot of the cows. But prior to 1970 and all through the 50s and 60s, they'd hayed, you know, traditionally they hayed all those meadows. And so they'd spend all summer stuck in the swamps and bogs haying those meadows so they could spend all winter feeding, you know, that hay up in those meadows. And 1970, they made the decision. It was a tough one. Let's quit haying that and see if we can graze it. Mm-hmm. So they, 1970, they let it stand, and then they started grazing those meadows in the winter and spring, and it worked very well. We
was that all under your management now, or were you?
That was just before I got there.
Okay.
In 1970, they started trying that, and you know, they had some growing pains and things. But in 1970, they started doing that instead of, you know, doing so much haying.
Mm-hmm.
And then it worked pretty well. In all the years that I was there, there was only three times that it didn't work, where the feed got snowed under and we had to bring the cows out of there for mm-hmm. part of the winter and feed them hay. And then we did get to go back in the spring and calve cows there. But
just based on our conversation, you know, before, it was 1975, one of those years.
Yeah.
It sounds like it might have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we had to buy hay for some of those years, but quite a bit of hay those 3 years, but because we couldn't produce enough.
Sure.
We were feeding it off the semis that we were hauling it in for that year. But at any rate, that's a real change going from feeding, providing that cut forage to a cow, everything that she needs, to letting her go graze it on her own. That was a major switch. And that's part of the reason why Fred Koch bought that place, because the same reason that Poindexter and Orr chose it because of those meadows and what they would produce with very low inputs. Yeah. So at any rate, we continued to do that through the years. And under my management, when we I was cow foreman, we did that. What we were finding, though, was that some of those meadows, we got to where we used two primary meadows for wintering. They were the swampiest ones, so but they grew a tremendous amount of forage and feed, and of course they had willows and creek running through them. But we could graze them in the winter, and the ground was froze, so you didn't harm any stream banks. They didn't eat on the willows or anything like that, and they'd take it right down to the duff, you know, and it was rough, you know, hummocks and swamp and a lot of sedge grass, but there literally was 2.25 to 2.5 tons of the acre in there. Uh-huh. But we would put like 1,500 cows in 850 acres from December to the end of March or middle of March, yeah. You know. And then we'd take them, split them up, and put them in other pastures that weren't as swampy, but had a lot of feed in them for the spring to calve in.
Yeah.
So we literally ran 4,000 to 4,500 cows with zero hay.
Wow.
We fed them 1 to 2 pounds. Some years, early years, we used protein block, 50-pound protein blocks. And then...
That was going to be my question, is did you have to supplement them on this?
Yeah, but like 1 or 2 pounds per head per day.
Yeah.
And then we switched when the protein blocks, it kind of went away, those 50-pounders or 33-pounders. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get into the tubs. That was later. But
yeah,
I just didn't feel like we'd get good enough distribution of the feed. The cows in those big groups like that were too aggressive. The aggressive ones were going to keep getting better, and the less aggressive were going to get too thin. So we used wheat mid cubes, and they were a pretty cheap, good source of 14% protein, which is what I needed.
Yeah.
And we'd put that out every other day, up to 2 pounds a head a day, every other day, and did that for years and worked extremely well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were able to go from making all of this feed and feeding it back out to not having, with the same land, like you didn't have to bring in extra hay or anything. They harvested the same feed. You just needed to supplement with a little bit of protein.
Yeah.
At that scale, that's got to be huge savings. I mean, the same amount of feed, just the cost to harvest.
It's unbelievable. All those tons. And then, but while I was cow foreman, and when Marion Cross, my predecessor's manager, was there, you know, he made a lot of improvements, and he was the one in charge there when they made that change, that grazing change in the winter. But still, we put up hay there at headquarters, and he'd feed, you know, heifers and first calvers, maybe second calvers down by headquarters. And they had to have hay, and they couldn't put up enough there at our headquarters. So in the late 80s, when I was still cow foreman, he would still put up 3,000 acres of hay there at headquarters. Well, take that back. They raised grain some too, until we did a real good enterprise analysis and realized that was doing nothing but costing us money.
Yeah.
And so we quit that about 88, but he still was buying about 5,000 to 7,000 ton of hay a year to cover us. And then I took over in 1990 and as general manager, and by 91, 92, we kind of changed the way we were doing things to where I went from buying 7,000 ton of hay to selling 2,000 ton of hay.
Wow.
9,000 ton of hay effect on the market in Dillon, Montana is big.
Yeah.
And I got like $72 a ton for the hay we sold. It was good hay too, but it didn't make sense to do that. So it, but it gave me an option. I knew I didn't have to have that much hay that we had in the past because I was doing different things and grazing them cows out more.
Yeah.
And so we changed some things. We split up those two 850-acre pastures where we wintered cows on grass. We split them up in five pieces, each with five pieces with electric fence, and we concentrated those cows. I mean,
yeah,
14 cows in a little bitty area through that same period of time. The reason I did that is because what we were doing, it's kind of like the difference between intensive management or short-term high-intensity grazing of a cow and season-long.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in when we did it, the where they had the whole pasture in the early years, where they had the whole pasture for the winter. Mm-hmm. Of course, they went through and picked through, and they got the best quality and most quantity early. And then as they got closer towards calving and the end of that grazing period, the quality and quantity was both down. So it was taking more supplement to keep them in the same body condition, or the body condition was failing. Mm-hmm. So what we did by splitting these up, we maintained and we could make them clean it up. I mean, and you could, for lack of a better term, you could cheat those cows a day or two, you know, and really mm-hmm. make it clean that up in the wintertime. And then boom, they get into this new fresh pasture, you know, and they're there for maybe 15 days or so, but so you maintained quality and quantity and body condition with less supplement also. And it really worked.
Yeah. How often were you moving them in that winter?
It depended on the size of the little paddock. We had it figured out how many days each one of them kind of needed to get through the season. And we'd monitor it, see. And we monitored body condition on cows. We did a lot of that.
Yeah.
But that worked very, very well. And then towards the end of that period, then we could go into different pastures or fresh pastures to calve on.
Yeah.
And so it worked very well.
And that's a huge thing, what you just talked about there. I mean, the difference between kind of giving them everything at once, that's what we do with our corn stalks, even in winter, is we let them, we kind of concentrate them down and give them in our area 5 days maybe worth at a time.
Yeah.
The idea being that if you give them everything that they need for a month or a couple months, they go out first few days and pick off all the good stuff, and by the end of it they're eating the worst. And you can see it in effect and condition pretty quickly.
So to expand on what we did there, that worked so well. I saw that worked so well, and I'm the guy, I try to be innovative and think, but just like I was saying, you see what works and how could you expand that and do that in other portions of the place. So we had 3,000 acres of hay ground, irrigated farm ground there at headquarters that we could produce hay on under pivot. And we'd run our first calvers, our replacement heifers. We'd have them out and then we'd bring them into the feed yard and kind of finish development just on hay. Mm-hmm. And then the first calvers and second calvers, we'd winter them down there and they'd kind of calve down in that area too. But we were traditionally feeding them hay off those hayed acres. And I saw what we could do up above and I was trying to figure out how can I make this work? But I've got this alfalfa. If I leave this alfalfa stand, you know, just leave it, it's going to turn to a worthless stem. The leaves are going to be on the ground. There's going to be no value there.
Yeah.
So about 1991, I come up with this idea, and there was a couple other people doing the same thing at the same time. We didn't know it, but a windrow and that second cutting. We cut and baled the first cutting in round bales, and then the second cutting, I just took one pivot, and you know, and the guys thought I was nuts. But anyway, I just wanted to see. So I didn't ask anybody to do anything. I swathed the pivot. I waited until after first frost on this second cutting hay. I swathed it and I raked two windrows together. and left it. And then I, that one was a small enough pivot. I didn't even electric fence it, but at the same time, I electric used some electric fence in another spot to winter 300 bulls behind. And everybody thought I was nuts there too. But after 2 days, there was never a bull out. And so that justified it, and everybody saw it could work. But anyway, I did that, and then I turned cows in on that, those windrows in February, late February, early March. It had gone through a lot of winter, you know, and that hay was just like the day we cut it. I mean, and they literally turned those windrows of hay into windrows of manure. And nobody had to feed them. The cows did great.
Yeah.
So from there, you know, I was exposing my guys and my crew to something different. I didn't ask them. They had no skin in the game. They, you know, if it didn't work, it was all on me. I didn't care. You know, I wanted to try. It worked so well that we expanded that to literally the whole farm.
3,000 acres of hay, you said.
3,000 acres of
it. Wow.
Yeah. And we've hayed the first cutting so we'd have enough hay for our replacement heifers in the feed yard.
Yeah.
And then the rest of them, we wintered them on those windrows. And then even some of them, we calved on. Yeah. But we had, it just made so much difference. Literally in 2000, by 2009, 2010, 2008, 2009, 2010, our non-grazable feed costs per cow on that ranch. So that included any supplement, any mineral, any salt, anything we had to purchase was $84 a cow.
Wow.
3 years in a row was just cents apart.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
We had neighbors right across the fence that were feeding 3.5 ton to the 3.5 ton of hay per cow.
Yeah.
That's how you make profit.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that I concentrated on that so much is in late 80s, us cowboys or foremen and managers, we sat down and did a detailed analysis of our business by enterprise. What we found was that when you put all your costs in, you know, you put them on a chart, a Pareto chart, and boom, all of a sudden, feed cost is like, it's like way out here.
Yeah.
Feed cost is like astronomical. And then you got labor is like here. And then depreciation is here. And then all these other things, these costs that we concentrate on, spend a lot of time on, like supplies and maintenance and fuel and all these things. There are all these little things right here. So yeah. I saw that's where I had the most opportunity to really work. And as we did, we did SPA data, standardized performance analysis. NCBA committee developed that with all bunch of ag economists, and they did that in the 90s. We participated in that for 7 years and entered all of our data into that thing, and it didn't matter what region, feed cost was the number one driver of costs in any operation, regardless of region. But you can't, in the same token, you can't starve a profit out of a cow.
Mm-hmm.
But to our point, and the reason we have some of the same philosophies, you got to have a cow that fits your environment.
And that was right where I was going to ask. Yeah. So again, tell me about that.
It absolutely is imperative. When I first came to the ranch in 1974, most of the country had straight Hereford cows. There was a little bit of crossbreeding started, but most of them were straight Hereford cows. They probably would hit a 975 to maybe 1,000 pound mature weight. That's what there was. And they were pretty functional. They're pretty reproductive. They fit their environment. We maintained that, and we kept that straight cow, Hereford cow herd all through the years. But I could see we were missing some, you know, from heterosis and crossbreeding. And we weren't hitting what we could. We were leaving a lot on the table. So, but I still maintained that we needed to have whatever we did with crossbreeding. Yes, you get advantages from heterosis, but the other thing that you get from heterosis is an increased cow size.
Yeah.
So you got to really be careful there. And so that's what I did. I concentrated as I selected for bulls, whether they be Angus or then Herefords in my breed rotations. There was moderate framed calving ease, and then with balanced carcass traits that I wanted. So I wanted to maintain my primary goal was to maintain a cow that weighed under 1200 pounds. I wanted them 1100.
Yeah.
That same years of 2008, 2009, 2010, all the cows that we sold off that place, either open cows, cull cows, or dry cows that lost a calf in the spring, be about 1,100 cows a year. We were running 7,000 cows.
Mm-hmm.
They averaged 1,107 pounds 3 years in a row, exactly the same weight 3 years. But those cows fit the environment, and as you probably read in the book, but they were reproductive. I mean, we got to the point when I first went there, they'd leave the bulls out 90 to 120 days, you know, gather them up, which is like a lot. I cut it down to 45 days. We were doing all that. The cows were calving 80% of them the first 21 days. They were breeding back, you know, in a 45 day period. We pulled the bulls at 45 days.
Yeah,
and on no hay, it worked.
That was awesome. That was the fifth most listened to episode, episode 113 with Ray Markser, titled "Cowboy in a Corporate World." He, has absolutely crushed it with what he did. But this next story is, well, these are all my favorites, so you might hear me say this is a favorite for me, because they're all favorites, which makes sense why they're all the top five listened to episodes. But the next one is Vanny Collins, and his story blew me away. When I was listening to his, I really struggled with trying to pull out just one clip to use and how to shorten it down and to use one clip here to get everyone to, you know, get something out of this and stuff, because everything he was saying was awesome. He took his ranch that he started ranching just 6 years ago, or maybe seven now, six when I recorded this. It's episode 79. He built a ranch with over 2,000 cows in 6 years. 6 years. And he did it leasing land from family, but he built the actual operations and the operating business from scratch. And so before people go out and say, you know, well, he had a family lease, that's not the same thing. You know, there's lease opportunities out there for everybody, but very few people are A, willing to take the opportunity or seek out the opportunity. Seeking it out is the first challenge. B, they're not willing to take the opportunity once they've found it. And C, if they do take the opportunity, very few people are able to accomplish what Vanny has accomplished in such a short period of time of scaling a ranch profitably in the way that he has. It's an incredible, incredible story. And I would, you know, take a listen to this. You'll hear, you know, a highlight of some of the things that he did, but then go back and listen to the whole episode, episode 79, again with Vanny Collins, building a profitable ranch. And I hope you enjoy this clip with Vanny. Well, that's fascinating. I didn't even realize that you essentially had started this cow-calf operation from scratch 6 years ago or 7 years or whenever that was. Now, I didn't realize that. I know when we talked a little bit about the scale and stuff, I mistakenly assumed that it had been, you know, a family ranch for a long time, because to accomplish what you've accomplished in the period of time that you have is pretty darn impressive. So let's dig into that if you don't mind. I mean, when you started coming in with, like you said, I mean, more of a private equity experience, no cattle production, you read a book that intrigued you and jumped into it. Where'd you go from there?
Yeah. So from there, I had a family friend who grew up on a ranch, and his dad ranched kind of same area. And I started talking with him, and he really pushed me to go to the ranching for profit school. Mm-hmm. So I did that. I did that in May of 16. I think I moved down here like in June of 16, and September of 16, I started breaking my first paddocks. But ranch for profit school was awesome. It was great. I had a strong financial background, obviously, before I started doing all this, but I never really understood livestock financials or the finances of livestock or the economics of it, because it's just it takes such a long time in the cow calf business, especially to like to produce cash flow. And so and it's really more of an equity business than a cash flow business. And so I didn't really understand that fully and how to account for the appreciation or the herd growth or whatever, you know. So that ranching for profit school is really, I mean, it's great. I loved it. Highly recommend it to anybody. It really got me I guess by the time I went to that ranching for profit school, I was already well down the road, like researching all different type of grazing. I had my friend who his dad was a huge ranch for profit guy. I've been a rancher for profit a bunch of times. It was obviously doing cell grazing, amp grazing. So I had a friend to kind of bounce ideas off of and kind of help guide me down the rabbit hole of the grazing world quite a bit. You know, I guess I was always interested in land and making it work, but I guess it's because I had a love for the land and, you know, just always felt real attached to land and taking care of it. And I just kind of always believed a lot in the potential of the land down here. So I guess by that point, I had already been like, I'd heard of Greg Judy, started reading The Stockman Grass Farmer, and I ended up having Greg Judy come down. And it was September of, I guess, 16, and I had just started grazing, and September is like a really rainy month, and this place had not had any cattle on it for quite a few years, so everything was like easy and beautiful and green, and so.
You look like a pro.
Yeah, exactly. Greg was telling me, like, you got to, like, get out there and break it up like this, like 10-acre paddocks. And it's like a 15,000 acre ranch, 10 acre paddocks, man. I was killing myself doing that. And
wow.
Yeah, but I didn't stick with that for long.
Okay.
Yeah. whenever I started out, we really had probably too many ranch hands whenever I started out. But it was really, really a blessing to have guys who had been here a lot longer than me kind of show me the way,
They were folks that were already on with the previous manager, kind of? Or?
Yes. Okay. I mean, a lot of these guys have worked out here like 10 to 20 years, you know, so long-term employees. I guess they were the ones that put in the water systems. So like having them here is like great, because there's water lines that have been buried out there for, you know, some of them 40 years. And it's like, I hate that, because it is... I wish you could just leave every water line on top of the soil and never worry about it. But finding those old water systems, especially finding, you know, when things go wrong, that was quite a learning curve. So yeah, I don't know. I was going down that kind of that grazing rabbit hole, and Greg Judy kind of recommended me, started mentioning Ian Mitchell Innes, and started hearing about Johann Seitzman, all these guys. And, you know, Ian was actually down here at a Grazing Lands Coalition meeting, doing a workshop, and a guy I had been buying some livestock from, Dr. Luke Farr, invited me to it, and he does those star cattle. He's out of he writes in The Stockman Grass Farmer sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I started working with Ian. And the rest was history after that, you know, just kind of off to the races.
Sure. Sure. So when you were first deciding kind of what business to be in, I guess, as far as cattle enterprises, why did you choose cow calf?
Yeah. You know, really it was I was scared, and it was I felt like I had so many more years to recoup if I ended up overpaying for an animal, I felt like I could get out of it over time. You know, it's a lot more flexible of a timeline, whereas stalkers were better know what you gain. You're in them for a very fixed period of time because they start to lose value if they go over a certain age. You know?
Yeah.
But really, I got into bison as well at first.
Really?
Yeah, I had a bison. Yeah. And I think, I don't even know where I, you know, the National Bison Association was like promoting bison on, they were promoting bison on like NPR. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't remember how I really got into it, but something like that. And I, so I bought a couple hundred and, you know, they were going, I was running with my cows and everything was going great there. And, after a couple of years, when I really started pushing the limits on density, or not pushing the limits, but actually getting density and pushing my water system, I started having issues with bison, kind of pushing my cows around and goring them and killing them.
You ran them together, cows and bison in a herd.
Yes.
Interesting. Is that common? I've never heard of that. Well, I guess I don't know that I know anybody who's got both bison and cows.
So there's a guy named Ken Clem. He is a producer out of Kansas. I think he's retired, but he's the one who kind of, I kind of look to his model to, I look to his production model as a model for me, kind of started going down that route. But, you know, the bison were tough. I was never going to get critical mass. All the slaughtering facilities, all the feed yards, everything are up in Colorado or north. And that's just trucking. Even back then, it was not going to be economical. Yeah. And, so I exited them and the market crashed after that. So I got lucky.
Good timing. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So bison was a couple year deal and learned a lot. We got to see some different type of grazing, but glad I did not go all in. Glad I was able to exit. But yeah, cow calf, really the only reason why I got into it is because I felt a little bit safer there. And also the idea of building a well adapted cow herd that is really low input is super attractive. And I'm starting to realize that vision now. And I realize, like, I'm starting to see, like, it is really a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
Like having an animal that can thrive in your environment, that was made in your environment. So it's, yeah, I mean, I've got animals now that are so much, and I'll go into the bulls and kind of genetics I've kind of gone down, but my animals now are so much more efficient, and I mean they're much smaller, and but not, I don't know, it works because the goal is about, I mean for me the goal is pounds per acre. Mm-hmm. Producing, and these smaller animals, any disadvantage I might have for selling an 1100 pound cow versus selling a 1400 pound cow, I'm recouping by how many cows I'm running. Sure. But yeah, it's just the health issues that you might be bringing in whenever you start with unknown or outside cows, the behavioral issues. I mean, there's herd dynamics that they have to settle. There's so much that goes into it. And it's really, I don't know, it's really nice having it. Now I've got a herd of cows that were all born here, bred and born on this ranch.
Sure.
And nothing over the age of four. And they are so easy keeping, they're low maintenance. You know, that it's so much easier now. And I mean everything is so much, the system is so much smoother. So so it, like I said, the first few years I think I bought in like a total of like 1200 animals. Mm-hmm. My first goal was like get to 600 or start out with like 100 and so odd cows. Mm-hmm. And bought in about 500, probably from sale barns. Just kind of have, I know an order buyer who is a really good guy, somebody I trust a lot. And so he was putting together these loads. We'd get deliveries every Sunday. All the meanwhile, I'm rotating. You know, it's the rotation. And I think at first, you know, I've had different people come out here over time, and some people would say like work on a 120 day rotation, work on whatever. And after I saw Ian at that school, I had him come out and consult with me. And like, I've been battling pink eye. I was getting, by this point, I was bringing in some red Angus genetics. You know, I had never dealt with P pink eye and the beef master, more Bos indicus type animals. Mm-hmm. And I started dealing with a lot of these Herefords and Red Angus that I was bringing in. Sure. And I was so stressed about it. It was such an ordeal. We used to froke the animals and squirt penicillin mm-hmm. in their eye, try every beer in the book. And I had Ian get out there and in the first 15 seconds, he's just like, oh, you're grazing too low on the plane. You just need to move faster. And it was oh, you're so right. Like that, it was just his experience. That was such a big problem for me to see him just come in 2 seconds, identify it, it's just, it was really, really.
He earned his money there for that consultant yes. day. Yeah.
And he gave me, he's done a lot for me. Whenever he got out here, I don't know. I don't know if you know much about EMS Linus, but the joke is he's always you don't have enough cows.
Oh, really? And
yeah. So whenever we used to move pastures, I used to call him whenever I was in the 600 to 1,000 head range. We'd be on a 200 acre pasture. And let's just say we'd be there for a couple days or a day. And I'd be out there on horseback with dogs and and my other cowboy. And we'd be leaving with a feed truck. And it was just it was so forced, and it just beating your head against the wall because the animals did not want to leave, and they'd be going around a fence and coming back along the fence on the other side of the fence. And so these cows on this side would see him walking that way and just go the opposite way. And I remember calling him and just venting, and he's just it's because you don't have enough cows, and it's funny because it's not just about the grazing, but kind of all part of the system. And once I finally got more cows, the cows, I don't know if it's they foul up the pasture so quick that they just want to leave, but the system works so much better with more cows. And it's been so, it's a beautiful system. I'm just kind of along for the ride. It's kind of doing its deal, and I'm just taking advice. So
that was episode 79 with Vanny Collins again, but I didn't mention that I actually had him on a second time along with a couple of other past guests. And that was just recently here on episode 145. I had Sage Askin, Chris Baggett, and Vanny Collins on to have a conversation specifically around building a first-generation ranch, because each of those have essentially built a first-generation ranch in different ways, unique ways of doing it, from direct marketing to custom grazing to a cow-calf herd, and all of them at a pretty impressive scale. So, I'd check out that episode too. That's episode 145. You can hear a little more of what Vanny Collins has to say about his experience. But moving to the third most listened to episode in the last 150 episodes, and that was episode 119 with Greg Judy, titled Profitable Ranching in Missouri. That is a story that I've been looking forward to hearing for a while. His books, there's a few of them, but No Risk Ranching is one that was one of my favorites and had a big impact on my mindset towards agriculture. He really was a pioneer in this idea of custom grazing cattle on leased land. And he shares a lot of value in this clip here of how he initially went about doing that, building relationships with landowners, managing the land, and building relationships with livestock owners, and the things you have to consider doing that. You should, again, as all of these, listen back to the whole story, because there's more than I can share in this clip. But enjoy this one here with Greg Judy. And again, that's episode 119.
Something I've asked a few different people I've had on my podcast, some who are very much land investment minded and some who are just getting started and everything. I kind of talk to people who are just getting started, and this question about land, whether they should start buying land and building a business off the land, or if they should start leasing land and using profits from that to try and invest back into land. And I've had answers both ways, actually. Some people believe that you just got to start building some equity in land and start doing it. And then there's a lot of people, I would say, who are really a fan and in favor of this kind of model that you, I would say, pioneered, this custom cattle on leased land. And it makes a ton of sense. And for you early on, when you were trying to figure out how you make a go of it, how did the idea of custom grazing on leased land even come up? Were there a lot of people doing that at the time, or
No, there wasn't anybody around here. There was nobody, Jared, around here doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was forced into doing it.
Yeah.
And I even kind of hate talking about it, but you know, I told you I was in this terrible divorce situation,
mm-hmm.
and it went on for 6 years. And so I could not own anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could still bring cattle on to our farm though and get paid like a service industry. So that's how it got started. I mean,
sure.
That, and I didn't have any money to buy cattle. Still had the land, and I was able to get more land and more land and more land. And I was never afraid of work. And I knew how to build high tensile fence. That was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I had exposure to was fiberglass post. I had a really good source of scrap fiberglass post. So fiberglass, your post, when you're building high tensile fence, that's about 60 to 70% of your fence costs are the darn fiberglass post. I was getting these things for, you know, 50 cents.
Wow.
50 cents a piece versus, you know, $4 or $5. And so
yeah.
I had a really competitive advantage on this fiberglass post. So yeah, things started falling together for me.
Yeah.
And then I got in with a sale barn owner and he started giving me all the cattle I could graze.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah. It was a really good way to start.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting just how you, and I know you don't want to dwell on that much, but how hard times force people to find different opportunities to make them work. You hear Gabe Brown's story of his 4 years of horrible years of drought, hail, really struggles that found kind of taught him this regenerative ag principles of things that has shifted his whole career, and your struggles that led to you building kind of a new enterprise model that sounds like it certainly wasn't popular, but has grown tremendously since then, which is awesome. And so, yeah, something to positive or silver linings of hard times. And I appreciate you sharing the origin of kind of where you learned that.
Yeah, I really believe, Jared, if you go through hard times getting to where you're going, first of all, it teaches you, it gives you calluses, it gives you experience, and it gives you confidence.
Mm-hmm.
The reason it gives you confidence, if you can survive 6 years of not having any money and not going bankrupt,
yeah.
that gives you quite a bit of
that's a good sign,
confidence. Yeah. You know, if I can get through that, I can get through anything. And
yeah.
That's what it did, you know, basically. So
yeah. Well, I think it's probably relatively understood, but I was actually just yesterday, somebody asked about how does someone get on Twitter, I should say. I like to follow Twitter for agriculture purposes, just educational purposes. And somebody asked, how can a person get into livestock agriculture anymore? And went on to say how it's almost impossible. And I made a post essentially saying, I think the best and only way probably is custom grazing on leased land. And a few people responded, what does that mean? And I was surprised that they didn't necessarily understand what that means. So I'd be maybe give you the opportunity here to give a little more detail as to what that means as far as an operation or how that, yeah, the, how that looked in practice.
You bet. So with the leased land, first of all, when you're leasing, you know, I never did a land lease without a written contract. I think you have to have that security. And I wouldn't lease a farm unless I could get it for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I had that, now I can work on that farm and I can do improvements to it because I know I'm going to have it for 5 years. And then it's my goal at the end of that 5 years for the landowner to be so pleased with what I'm doing. He may give me another 5 or 10 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't plan on losing that lease. Now, yeah. I know things come up, people have to sell land and they have to do that. And I've had that happen to me a few times. But on the custom grazing, so what I was basically doing for steers, I was charging a set rate. I started out getting paid by the pound of gain, and I went away from that pretty quickly. We started getting paid there at the end. We were getting 70 to 75 cents a day for a 400-pound steer. And so that was paid by the 10th of the following month. That bill was due. If there was any doctoring that had to be done to those steers, they had to buy the medicine and I did the doctoring. Okay.
Sure.
Also, I provided all the water, the labor to move them. I gave them a place to load them, and I assisted in loading those animals on load day. Mm-hmm. And when I took the animals, I guaranteed them so many months that I would keep them. So the biggest cost of custom grazing for the cattle owner, well, one of the biggest, would be the hauling to your farm. It's expensive to haul cattle. And so if you're going to have somebody bring cattle to you, you've got to be prepared to take them from the spring flush, which in our area was April 15th to the end of September. That's what I would take. Sure. End of September, they need to come and get them because I'm out of grass. I'm trying to get the cattle off actually the 1st of September so my farms can stockpile, and then I would bring in dry cows for the winter. So the reason I was getting paid 12 months out of the year because I was running cattle 12 months. The winter program was the cattle owners, they bought the hay, okay? It was their cows. They bought the hay. I had it hauled to my various leased farms, and then I fed that hay to their cattle on my leased farms. Well, Jared, a lot of our farms are very poor when we first started. I mean, that's why I got them. They wouldn't grow much. But once I started feeding hay on them and unrolling hay and feeding livestock, that they took off. So I was getting $1.25 a day at the very end there. That would have been in, let's see, 2007, 2008, 2009. That were my last years I did custom grazing. About $1 to $1.25 a day per cow-calf pair. Yeah. And, you know, that was pretty good money. It gave me some money. And the landowner, here's the advantage. Now, you're asking, I'm sorry, the cattle owner, why would he do that? Why would he bring you cows? Well, there's lots of reasons. One is he doesn't have to deal with them. The other deal is if you can bring cattle onto your farm in the summertime and get them off your own personal farm, man, you can grow a lot of grass. And so they would bring, so I was getting fall calving cows in the springtime, okay? I would take them in until, let's say, the 1st of September. They would come and get those cattle, and they would bring me the cows that had been spring calved. They'd taken the calves off. They'd weaned them. They were bred back. So I was always dealing with cows that most of the time didn't have calves on them. I liked that. I didn't have to calve them that way.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, when you calve other people's cows, people keep cows that I wouldn't keep. Some of those cows can get pretty snotty, you know. They really can. I found out that there's some people that need to call cows that they don't call. And the reason they don't call them is, well, you know, she's just being a cow, protecting her cattle. I'm like, she tried to kill me. Those cows need to be in Hamburg, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't need to be on your farm.
Yeah. And that's probably one of the reasons that I want to get into why you've shifted out of custom grazing, like you mentioned there, and to owning livestock. But if you don't mind a little more questions on this, one of the things probably when you're building a business, custom grazing cattle for other people and on land that you don't own, it sounds like it's very much a relationship type business that more so than the average farmer, cattleman and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about how you built those relationships, how you sought out land, reached out to them, and then how you maintained those throughout your kind of, you know, your business?
Yes. So when I started out looking for land, I was convinced from where I lived at, I live in a very rural area. There weren't a lot of houses around me. And so I just made a rule. I wasn't going to lease any land that was further than 10 miles from my house. So I got a map and I drew a 10-mile circle around my home. And any farm that fell within that 10 miles, I would go and check it out and try and get a lease on it. And kind of what happened to me, Jared, was I got my first lease. It was in 1999. And I worked on that lease. I worked on it hard and really cleaned this whole farm up, got some water put on it, pretty decent fence, and basically took a very abused farm that looked like just a brush holler and turned it into this beautiful land. It looked like you landscaped it with livestock. We worked on it hard, took a lot of the brush off,
yeah,
painted the stumps to make sure we didn't get sprouting back. And so other people started seeing what we were doing. And so that first farm gave me a template to bring other people and look at what we were doing. But the way I got that first lease farm, believe it or not, I didn't know the guy from Adam. He lived in Dallas, and it was a long ways, you know, from Missouri, of course. And so I went and took a VCR camera, one of those big old heavy ones, yeah. The ones you put on your shoulder.
Yeah.
And I walked out onto my farm, and I was custom grazing a friend's steers. This was all going on during that divorce thing. Mm-hmm. And I had these beautiful steers, and I went out and did a paddock move on my farm. I had my farm set up into rotational grazing, explained what the calves were doing, the manure, the dung beetles, the earthworms, the trampling, keeping them out of the ponds, clean water, the whole nine yards, and did a paddock move with them. And these calves were really doing it. They were gaining over 2.5 pounds a day on my pastures. And I sent that VCR tape to that landowner in Dallas. The minute he watched it, I got a phone call. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "We need to talk." He said, "I'm interested in doing something. I would love for you to write up a lease." And so I did. I wrote up a lease proposal, and I went for 10 years. I'm like, "You don't have any fence." I said, "If you want me to come here and build that whole thing up, I've got to have your farm for 10 years. So that's kind of how I approached it. Yeah. And to give you the long and the short of that farm, he ripped my lease up after 1 year. He just ripped it up and told me my lease wasn't any good. And I about had a heart attack. And he said, "No," he said, "my wife and I talked it over." He said, "We're going to give you a lifetime lease." So we've got a lifetime lease on that farm now.
Wow. Awesome conversation with Greg. There's a ton of ways to learn more about what he does through his books, through this podcast, and through his YouTube channel. So I'd really encourage you to learn and listen more to what he has done. He's got a lot of content out there in different forms and will be well worth checking out. Moving on to the second most listened to episode of the first 150, that was episode 80 with Jordan Thomas. And in that episode, he shares what to me probably is something everybody already understands or isn't that revolutionary, but to me it was one of those light bulb moments where you really think about things a different way. And he talked a lot about the importance of essentially selecting for earlier calving animals. And it seems like an obvious thing you would want to do is have earlier calving animals, but yet a lot of people still turn bulls out for 60, 80, 90, 120 days, or just never pull the bulls back in, and they have cows calving year round whenever they kind of happen. And we really dive into why that's a poor business decision, as well as a lifestyle decision. You're worrying about calving all year, but a poor business decision to do that, and why those cows are just poor investments. And he really does a great job of breaking that down and talking about that. And then briefly diving into, and he talks more about it in the episode than I think what I have here, but how we can use reproduction tools like syncing and AI to maybe improve that part of the business and just to make it a more profitable business. So really enjoyed this conversation. He's been on twice as well. And his part two was episode 130. So again, his first episode, episode 80. His second episode, episode 130. Lots to learn from Jordan Thomas, but we'll dive into the section I cut out here.
Yeah. So, you know, we could do some of that with something like a partial budget analysis, right? Where we just look at, well, what is the cost of using synchronization and AI, and what is our anticipated returns? Maybe what cost do we eliminate out of the program by potentially being able to run fewer natural service bulls per cow, you know, drop that ratio down because we did a timed AI to start breeding season. And, you know, you can play with those numbers and they can tell an interesting story. And you can often show that use of that technology is particularly profitable and even in just the first year. But I think the way that I have started to think about it is actually pretty different than that. Because if you really dig into the data, the thing that really drives reproductive outcomes in cow-calf herds is what happened last year. And sometimes that's hard to communicate. But let me say it this way. So the cow that conceives on day one of the breeding season, you know, 283 days later, you know, she calves on day one of the calving season, roughly. Obviously, there's biological noise there, but it's about 82 days, right, until that next breeding season starts. And she has to go through this period of time called postpartum anestrus. It's controlled at the level of the brain. It's influenced by her body condition, reserves, you know, it's influenced by whether she's a two-year-old cow, whether she's a running age cow. It's influenced by the energy that's out in front of her and her environment. You know, what is she actually able to consume? Can she stay in positive energy balance? Influenced by the presence of her calf at side. You know, it's influenced by all these sorts of things in terms of how long that period of time actually is. But in most cases, you know, 82 days later, she's cycling and she's ready to go. And it's not an issue for that cow that kept conceived early, calves early. But if you take even something as short as a 60-day breeding season, which I think for many cow-calf operations around the country is a kind of wishful thinking in terms of the calving season being that short. But let's say that cow that calves on day 60 of the calving season, she doesn't have 82 days. She has 22 days until that next breeding season starts. And so mathematically, that cow is a different beast. I mean, she's a different investment, right? Mm-hmm. Because that cow that calves that late in the calving season is not cycling at the start of the next breeding season, except in the rare outlier kind of situation. But she's not capable of becoming pregnant early in the next breeding season. And she's also pretty disproportionately likely to be open during the course, you know, at the end of that breeding season, because she has fewer opportunities to conceive. Knowing what we know about, you know, reproduction now in cattle, you know, if we give cows, for example, one opportunity to conceive, we can go in on day 8 and flush out the reproductive tract and we might have a viable embryo about 95% of the time. But you go out 3 weeks later and you're lucky to have 75% of those cows bred, right? So we lose a lot of early embryos in cattle. So that early embryonic loss issue just means that cows really need to have multiple opportunities to conceive during a breeding season, or we're just going to stand to have a lot of them be non-pregnant. So these later calving cows, two things happen, right? They're not going to become the early conceiving cows just magically next year. And they're also disproportionately likely to go from being a bred cow in terms of their value to being an open cow in terms of their value. And so those cows depreciate a lot more in that production calendar, if you will. I sometimes make the beef production capstone class in our Division of Animal Sciences do a profit and loss calculation for every cow in a, you know, imaginary spreadsheet and try to actually show the anticipated decline in cow value for certain classes of cows, like based on when they conceived during the breeding season. And what they'll find is that those cows that conceive later in the breeding season, therefore would be expected to calve later in the calving season, they essentially incur a pretty heavy reduction in their inventory value. So they contribute to that overall cost of cow depreciation that happens in that next calendar year, just as a function of conceiving late and being more likely to be open next year. Then the other thing that happens, obviously, is they wean the lightest, youngest calf in the group. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that drives calf weaning weight is really just calf age at weaning. Yeah. And so really for multiple reasons, reproductive management in cow herds is incredibly important, but it's a multi-year process. And so last year's success kind of sets the stage for this year's success, and last year's problems kind of create this year's problems. And so either way, you know, it's either a vicious cycle or it's a virtuous cycle. It's either getting worse or it's getting better. And really that's the part that takes a little bit of work to address. Synchronization can kind of help start turning that in one direction or the other, right? But it's really that year-long commitment to shortening the calving season progressively over time that creates the real opportunities.
Interesting. Okay. That's really interesting. And so I had not really considered much that statement there that you had made either about like the greatest impact or effector of weaning weight is birth date, and until this spring when I went to the Ranching for Profit School and there was a person in our class who was part of the, he was, I think, in school, a PhD candidate or something during working with the guy who made the Wilt Bank principles or whatever. You probably
was it Mike Smith?
I apologize. That was back in April or something. Yeah. But he was in my class and he said that. And I was like, gosh, that seems like such an obvious thing that I never would have like just put together is how simple that is. And, but it made me think too, like how, when we have our vets come out and preg check our cows and we do a 60-day window. And while we've been breeding in 45 days and selling everything that's bred after 45 to 60. But I was asking, you know, what do most people do? Like 90 days, 80 day or whatever and stuff. And there's, and most people keep their bulls in year round, or most people have a 90 to 120 day window. And yet they sell their calves all in one big group at the same time. They've got this massive range and spread of calves. And it's like, you know, man, that to me was almost an eye-opening thing. One of those, I don't even know what you call them, just like little light bulb moments or something that was kind of interesting to me. But so I'm starting to see maybe now where you're maybe going with, and how do you get towards moving towards improving that, that shorter breeding window and that shorter calving window then?
Well, it's really funny that you mentioned that, you know, I'm sure that you're talking about Mike and Stephanie Smith, because I know that they actually went to that ranching for profit school.
Okay, nice. Mike that must Smith have been
was,
them.
Yeah. Mike Smith was a Jim Wiltbank student, and Jim Wiltbank is one of the, you know, the kind of that second generation of reproductive physiologists and kind of the animal science field. And I still cite his data all the time because it makes such a good point, which is, you know, that the main driver of productivity in cow-calf operations in terms of what a cow actually produces revenue-wise for that year is when she gave birth to that calf during the calving season. How old is that calf at weaning? Because from birth to weaning, you know, a beef calf is going to gain somewhere between 1.6 and maybe 2.4 pounds a day. So let's say we take that 2 pounds a day midpoint. Well, that means about every estrous cycle worth of time, so every 21 days, 3 weeks, it's 40 pounds, yeah. 42 pounds. I mean, so you think about, you know, you go out to a bull sale and maybe you look at weaning weight EPDs, or maybe that's on your mind a little bit. And I'm not saying you should emphasize that or you shouldn't. Obviously, we know how Kit feels about that. I get that. Well, we have a major opportunity to just improve the phenotypes that we get in terms of actual weaning weights. Aside from the genetic selection piece, which is, you know, I would argue at least is a little bit important in the right context, but aside from that piece of it, I mean, we have a major opportunity to actually improve actual weaning weights, really with our cow retention decisions, because those cows that, you know, at a pregnancy diagnosis, for example, like it sounds like you're doing in your own operation, if you go in and you identify that cow that's conceived on, you know, essentially day one of the breeding season, and that cow that's conceived on day 60 of the breeding season, they have radically different net present values as cows. I mean, they really do, because one is disproportionately likely to be an open cow next year, that later conceiving cow. And so she is going to incur a pretty substantial loss in value, not necessarily her. I mean, she might prove you wrong, but that class of a cow will disproportionately be likely to be open next year at preg check. And so we got to account for that and how we think about her value potential change, right? And then she's also going to wean a calf. Think about that day one versus day 60. That could legitimately be 120 pounds of calf weaning weight. I mean, that's wild. That's incredibly wild that there's that much of difference top to bottom. Yeah. So I always argue, and it's kind of I'll give some credit to Wally Olson and Doug Ferguson and Bud Williams and all those folks that talk about, you know, sell by marketing, or just maybe being willing to market some cows that are overvalued. In my state, and I think in Minnesota as well, and really in most parts of the country, I would argue cows are overvalued in the market just because they're bred. And you can really capture the value of bred females, especially young bred females, while knowing that in your own operation, that particular cow, that later conceiving cow, really has no profit potential, or at least has the poorest profit potential of the group. Mm-hmm. And so just what an opportunity, right, to divest out of cows that have poor profit projections for the next production cycle and to redeploy that equity into something that has more profit potential.
Well, that's really interesting. So I think Wally Olson talks about that being like intrinsic value is what is, say, right now in or May 1st, you're looking calving starting or something, and you've got this cow that's going to calve May 1st and this cow that's going to calve June 30th. and you look at their intrinsic value is what they'll be worth in the fall minus the cost to get there, essentially. And so in the fall, you'll have one cow with, say, a 550-pound calf and another cow that June 30th one with a 450-pound calf, or, you know, maybe even a wider spread than that. And the on average, those June 30th calves are going to have a significantly higher open rate because they had less time to get bred back versus that smaller cow. So chances are she's actually going to be worth less that at that point as well. The calf will be worth less, and your costs are going to be the same between the two. You know, am I kind of understanding correctly then that logically it would make sense to select for more earlier calving cows on a regular basis because that intrinsic value at that time over, you know, a herd average will be significantly higher from the earlier calving cows?
Absolutely. I mean, you nailed it. I mean, absolutely. The cost structure is the same for those cows. I mean, it really is. But yeah. Other than if you consider depreciation as a cost, you know, then obviously the later conceiving cow has a higher cost. But it just depends on how you, if you're focusing about exactly. Yeah. Now you're talking about it with all of the value on the top side, and so that really makes sense. I completely agree.
And moving on to the most listened to episode in 150 episodes, I'll give you a moment to guess, and you maybe guessed it right. I know a lot of people probably have. It was Alan Savory, episode 100. He was actually the last kind of milestone episode guest that I had. I thought I'd have him on for episode 100, and now he's making a debut here on the 150th as the most listened to episode. And it's really hardly even close. I've had a lot of people reach out telling me how much they enjoyed that episode, how thought-provoking and mind-expanding that it was. And I know it sure did expand my mindset. And a lot of the conversation, I probably felt like, I did feel like he was way over my head and in his thinking, and it just blows my mind sometimes. But it's just a really good perspective on management and how the average, you know, how we think we're managing more than what we are, but in reality, we are managing three things, essentially the social aspect of people around us and our families and whatnot, the natural resources that we have, and the money or economies that we have. And that's the same for individuals, farms, families, or large institutions, which he talks about as well, and the wicked problems that are associated with large institutions. And so that is a little bit about what he talks about in this clip, but so much more to go back and listen to. I've had people telling me that they're listening to this 3, 4 times, 5, 6, 7 times. So it might be the most listened to episode because people are re-listening to it so much. But either way, that's a pretty awesome testament to what it is. And Alan Savory has had just such a huge impact on, I think, all of us, whether we know it or not. A lot of the things that we talk about in this podcast and what ranchers and farmers do is going to come from things that he has pioneered or learned or shared or talked about somehow. So huge influencer in this space and in the world, really. And it's such an honor to talk to him. And I'm grateful and excited and honored to say that he was the most listened to episode in the first 150. And so we'll dive into that short clip here.
Now, people believe that we manage millions of things. No, we do not. We produce millions of things. You are producing this podcast. Your farmers you work with produce food. Other farmers in other ways produce food. We produce cell phones. We produce cars. We produce music. We produce orchestras. We produce cities, roads, bombs, weapons, space exploration vehicles. Everything that makes civilization possible is produced, not managed. That's logic, all right? So then what do we manage? And we only manage three things. Now, the world believes that we manage millions of things and that there's many ways you can manage. You can manage dictatorially, democratically, scientifically, whatever. Mm-hmm. No, there are whole libraries, there are whole universities that teach management. And they don't teach that we only manage three things. We manage our lives. We do not produce those. Okay? Everything we produce, let me go back to that for a moment, Everything we produce stops if we stop producing it, even food. Nothing you produce keeps going if you stop producing it. Nothing we produce is complex. They're very complicated. I can't even understand a computer, a cell phone. I'm illiterate to these things, all right? But they are not self-renewing. They're not self-organizing, which is what complexity means, as against complicated, all right? So when we look at what we manage humans, our families. You manage your family, I do, we all do. And then we manage our farm or our business, and we manage within our community, all right? We don't produce that, we manage it. Now, to manage your family or your farm or any business or anything, okay, you have to manage the economy, because if you can't finance your farm, you can't keep going. If you can't finance your family, fund it, you can't keep going, all right? So you manage your family or you manage humans, you manage the economy in which you grow up. And this used to be centuries and centuries ago, just barter. And now it's become a complicated economy, but you manage the economy. Now, only when you're managing humans and the economy, now do you manage nature. And nature, that means the environment. And everything you produce comes from the environment. And everything you throw out at waste goes back to the environment. Everything is cycling in the environment. So those are the three things. We do not produce them. They do not stop. If you stop, if millions of people die, as happens in wars and so on, the nation carries on, the country carries on, everything carries on, but in changed form. If thousands of species become extinct, nature carries on, but in changed form. They don't stop. It just changes the form because it's self-organizing. Now, if economies collapse completely, as I've experienced in Zimbabwe with the highest inflation ever in the history of the world and the complete collapse of our economy, nothing stopped. It just carried on with the black market, which was more honesty, more integrity than the mainstream economy. And it kept the country going, all right? So economies, even if everything collapses, people keep going, even if they fall back to just bartering. It never stops. Now, nature is the same. It just keeps going, but in damaged or changed form. Now, every species, and we are a species, is dependent on its habitat. And humans are destroying human habitat. And that's what I first picked up in national parks. They were like the Welsh miners carrying canaries into the mine. And if the canary fell off the perch, it was a bloody good time to get out of the mine immediately. Mm-hmm. Okay, the canaries have been falling off the perch in national parks in America, all over. And we've just been ignoring it all my life. Okay, so those are the three things we manage. And so if you go to, let's say, COP, because COP27 is coming up, and I'm just going to pick that because that's the ultimate biodiversity loss, you know, desertification, fire, climate change. If you go to the last COP, not a single person except myself talked about management.
What are they talking about?
They're talking about production. I was asked to talk about regenerative agriculture. I said, I won't do that. All I'll do is start conflict. Because if I talk about regenerative agriculture, millions of other people will talk about mainstream chemical technology agriculture. Whereas, so if you went to COP and you go to COP27, which is coming up, you will find people talking about how to produce energy. You will find people talking about how to produce food. And if we look at the agricultural part of it, which we're doing at the moment, when you look at that, you'll find that the bulk of the people, supported by billionaires, celebrities, everything will be in the anti-meat, anti-blah-blah-blah movement, and they will be promoting production of food based on technology and chemistry. And you'll find a minority, very small minority, tiny, who will be promoting agriculture, producing food by farmers based on biological science. They happen to be right, but they're losing the war because the whole world is going the other way, because that's where the money, the celebrities, the universities, the professors, everybody is talking about production. And I can promise you right now, you won't find anybody talking about management. So there's no hope of anything for the next 100 COP conferences until we start talking about the cause of the problem. And now, again, that comes down to childishly simple logic, science, that if you don't address the cause of a problem, you have no hope of addressing the problem. So all I'm doing is applying science and common sense. And for over 50 years, I've had condemnation, and the only evidence against me is proof by authority. Professors in range science at Texas A&M University or in Oxford say I'm wrong. That's not science. That's proof by authority. That's what was used against Galileo, Copernicus. Nothing has changed since then.
And I guess the resistance, I'm wondering if, I don't fully understand why the resistance in agriculture specifically, it seems like maybe there's so many individual, I guess, managers that to somehow align all of the managers in some sort of a aligned goal would be nearly impossible. So I guess maybe that's some of the resistance, but on, especially on national parks where the control is solely in the control of one, you know, the park national, the DNR and different things and stuff. I mean, is that, what's the resistance to this change and shift on focus?
It's absolutely understood. It's, if you just read the science and the research, the system science, wicked problems of institutions. I said the first thing we manage is humans. Now you've got two scales at which you manage. Again, let's just come down to science and common sense. You and I can manage at the family level. Everybody listening to us can manage at the family or the local farm level. All right? Beyond that level, you manage through institutions, organizations. You cannot manage a war as an individual. Armies do. You cannot manage a country as an individual. Governments do. You see what I'm saying? So you've got the human scale of management, and then you've got the large scale of management, which is always through institutions. Now, institutions are complex, self-organizing. And what we didn't know when we formed them, because we have to have them, and they're essential, and they're our most efficient way of doing something, what we didn't know was that they were complex. And that the moment we form an institution, it takes on a life of its own. It doesn't behave like a human being does. If a human being murders somebody or accidentally kills somebody, they face severe consequences. If a company, corporate board, CEO accidentally or deliberately kills millions of people, they get a multi-million dollar award and leave. They don't behave like humans. Let's just take religion. I'm not a religious person, but I observe what goes on. And if I just take one religion, which most of our listeners probably belong to, which is Christianity. Now, Christianity, we can manage at the family level, and every human tries to do so. And the message of the founder was painfully simple, basically love and caring. And you and I can do that, our families can do that, and I do, and everybody does. Now, what happened thousands of years ago when we started to manage religion at scale? Now we managed it through institutions. Now what happened? We've got, I believe, something like 2,000 branches of Christianity. How many centuries have we been killing each other, maiming each other, torturing each other, going to war? And so the institution will go against its very purpose. The Catholic Church is millions of wonderful people who love and care. What about the church? If you want real job security in the world, greater than any worker or anything, just be a paedophile priest. It's going against the very purpose of the church, which is to protect the innocent, the children. And nobody's being bad. That is how institutions behave. It's a wicked problem. There's another one, wicked problem that's well known is you and every listener is capable of common sense, as we're using in this talk. Institutions are almost incapable of common sense. So you could ask almost anybody in America, does it make sense for us to produce oil and coal to grow grain to produce fuel for vehicles? And every sane person will say, that's not sensible. How many thousands of highly educated, far more intelligent than I am, scientists in America are doing that? How many are protesting? It's normal. Nobody's being bad. That's how institutions are. So they will go against their very purpose and never admit they're wrong. I mean, in the TED talk, I admitted how wrong we were. Okay. And that led to the government killing 40,000 elephants. And it got worse, not better, as all of us scientists believed it would get better. I'm one scientist in the world that said, no, it got worse. Why couldn't all the other scientists acknowledge that? I was independent. I was not working for an institution. Every other scientist was working for an institution, and institutions will not admit to error. So we need to be aware of that, and we are. In the way we've developed a solution to this in 1983, we take awareness of that into account. Nobody's being bad. It's just how complexity works in institutions. So as we manage at scale through institutions, we need to be aware of that.
So there it was. Some of my favorite moments from the top five episodes in the first 150. Again, I just want to say thank you so much to all of you listening. There are thousands of you now out there. It's which absolutely just blows my mind that this has reached as many people as it has. I sure do appreciate it. I hope the podcast continues to be a blessing to you who are tuning in, so that you can continue to listen and learn and hopefully apply some of these things within your own businesses and continue to improve your operations. That's really what this is about. I'm just hoping that each episode provides a little bit of value for you that you can apply to your farm or ranch and hopefully be more profitable and more enjoyable and just improve it for the next generation. That's what this is all about. So thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this, and we'll have to continue to do these every now and then to highlight some of the favorite episodes that people have. So thanks so much, and we'll see you next week on the Herd Quitter Podcast.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.